Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Thank you very much. I understand that I arrived in Santa Barbara on the day it's rained earlier in the fall than in living memory. So we get so much sunshine in Denver, it's nice to have a break now and then, and appreciate your providing that for me. In case you're wondering what the stool is doing up here, I have a knee that is missing certain crucial parts, so I will not be able to stand between now and 9 o'clock or however long we go, and from time to time I will sit, but hope that that doesn't disrupt your evening too much. Thank you for the introduction. Now let me give you the real title of... actually, it was close. You should have a handout in front of you that you were given, which I tried to put enough detail on it so that those of you that really don't want this to feel like another class can at least have an idea where I'm going, and you can, as they say in the IMAX theaters, sit back and relax. But for those of you that really are serious students, there's at least little tiny bits of space for you to jot a note or two. I've entitled this New Developments in Historical Jesus Research, which is simply a pompous way of referring to the fact that Jesus continues to be the topic of extensive writing and research, all the way from very popular best-selling books in the average secular bookstore, all the way to very technical works of biblical scholarship. And I want to survey the landscape with you a little bit tonight, let you know what's out there. Some you will have probably heard of, much may be new to you, and then try to help evaluate a little bit of what that landscape involves, and then bring us to some conclusions. I start by referring, perhaps arrogantly, to what I have called popular mythology. But I think it would be fair to say that university professors from whatever spectrum or background or ideology would agree on one thing, and that is that not every book about Jesus, however new or touted or marketed it may be in the popular bookstore, necessarily reflects scholarship at all. And I've given three categories of works that may be well-known or not so well-known in various circles that fall under what I have labeled popular mythology. The first, still sounding very arrogant, I have labeled perspectives unrelated to any real historical evidence. One example of several that I can think of is a professor retired from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences just up the coast, a state from here at Oregon State University, who in his retirement became interested in UFOlogy and became convinced that a German document that he read by a German UFOlogist was in fact the original Gospel of Matthew. It looked very much like the Bible's Gospel of Matthew, except at key points where Jesus wound up being an alien from outer space who came to this planet to dispense New Age wisdom. Rather remarkable that someone who's had an illustrious career as a university professor in a particular field could fall for something like this and write two books, one of which was published by an almost reputable academic press. But it's out there. A brand new book that is a very good book this year by a man named Robert Van Voorst on the evidence for Jesus outside the New Testament has one lengthy introductory chapter which does nothing but refute the various people throughout the history of modern scholarship who have tried to deny that Jesus ever existed, notwithstanding the fact that there is all kinds of non-Christian evidence from the ancient world to support that. That stuff is out there. People know about it, and an informed response needs to be made. Then there's a second category that I've labeled distortion or misrepresentation of recently discovered evidence. Now, I'm using recently very generously here, as in within the last 50 years or so, given that Christianity's been around for 2,000. The Dead Sea Scrolls. Most of you undoubtedly will have at least heard of them. Discovered in Israel just after World War II, have both in their initial finding and then in the 1990s, after a flurry of translation efforts, completed the previously untranslated fragments, have at times spawned all kinds of sensationalist claims in the media, many of which are simply not true. One of the strangest, and she continues to write even as we speak, are the writings of an Australian scholar by the name of Barbara Thiering. I had the privilege of speaking in Australia for 3 weeks in August and was running into people who had heard about her work in a number of different contexts, who argues that because of what we learned about Jewish backgrounds from the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Jewish community that went out into the Judean wilderness and created a kind of a commune and set up religious rules for themselves, that we can now go back to the New Testament and decode it and discover that all of the main characters, Jesus and Paul and the various apostles, were actually Essene Jews and also members of this monastery at a site called Qumran. Nobody in the scholarly world, to my knowledge, of any spectrum, of any place on the spectrum, has accepted this theory. But it's out there, and it's sold more copies of books than anything I'll ever write, which means that I need to continue to worry about the problem of envy and continue to work on that. Then, in a very different category, and there are more examples that could be given in each of these, I've listed what I call unfounded claims of textual corruption. And again, this is not an issue that divides bona fide biblical scholars. It is widely agreed that the text, particularly of the New Testament, certainly of both Testaments compared to works of the ancient world in general, but particularly the New Testament because of the thousands of manuscripts, first in Greek and in other ancient languages, that have been preserved from the first millennium of the Christian era, hundreds from the first several centuries, from fragments to relatively complete documents, that we are able to reconstruct with 97, some would say 99%+ certainty, what the original New Testament writers wrote. Now, that's a completely different question than, do we believe what they wrote? But if we're not even sure if we have accurate copies and translations of what they wrote, then that makes the truth question, the question that the Veritas Forum asks, even that much harder to get at. But it's widely agreed that we have the New Testament in particular in better textual shape than any document from antiquity on any topic whatsoever, specifically because it was so crucial to such a large group of people that care was taken that it would be very carefully preserved. That fact is very important in conversations with friends of ours who may represent either the Muslim religion or, closer to historic Christianity, the Mormon faith, because in their writings, in the Quran and the Book of Mormon and other writings of Joseph Smith, more particularly, there are claims that the New Testament was not well preserved, either that certain portions had gotten distorted and we don't have the stories accurately of what the people wanted to tell us, or that entire missing books have been left out. At some point, we probably need to study a little bit about that so that we can get the facts straight. But now I want to come to what I want to spend most of our time together tonight on, and that's what I have called the scholarly spectrum. If scholars are agreed that works in these first three categories do not represent the truth or anything close to it, there is still a huge spectrum within bona fide scholarship with what has been called the quest for the historical Jesus, a quest that really encompasses largely the last 200 years of the 2000 that Christianity has existed. In the 19th century, more or less the first 100 years, with a little bit beginning already just before the 19th century, there were many different philosophical schools that all spawned books about the life of Jesus. In an age when science was increasingly coming to doubt the miraculous, there was a rationalist school of philosophy that tried to preserve elements of New Testament faith and the Gospel's pictures of Jesus, but explaining the apparently miraculous with rationalistic explanations. Jesus didn't really walk on the water. There were sandbars or stones shortly beneath the surface, and in the night in a stormy period of time on the lake, Jesus walked out on these and it was mistaken for a supernatural event, and other examples of that kind. There was a philosophical school that increasingly studied the religious work of antiquity in terms of myth and in terms of legend, and tried to also wrestle with the question of the miracles of Jesus and of the New Testament, not by giving them scientific explanations, but by saying that these were not written as stories designed to communicate historical fact in the first place. Like many religions in the history of the world, they were sacred myth. They were not true stories of something that happened, but they communicated theological truth, things that people believed were important. There was a school of philosophy known as Romanticism, which for those of you that haven't studied philosophy has nothing to do with Hollywood movies. Back in the area when, in the era when they were romantic rather than just lustful, which seems to be increasingly the case. And out of this school came a picture of Jesus as a wonderful, kind teacher who inspired the crowds, who uplifted and exalted his audiences with lofty thoughts, but did little that would embroil him in controversies sufficient to get him crucified. And then there was yet another school of thought that today, after another century has passed, is sometimes called the old or the 19th century liberal position, influential in many aspects of the settling of America back before we had crowded this country to the extent that we have now. And there was optimism that Americans in particular and Christians as a significant part of them were going to Christianize the earth, we're going to create a better humanity and a better earth than had ever been seen in its history before. It talked about the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man long before anybody dreamed up inclusive language and the problems that those terms would create. Until at the end of the 19th century, a young German scholar who would live into his 90s, into the 1970s, by the name of Albert Schweitzer, who would go on one day to have an illustrious career in West Africa as a humanitarian doctor, medical doctor, as well as a theologian. Albert Schweitzer wrote a book that was translated into English in 1906 with the title, The Quest of the Historical Jesus. And what it was a several hundred page, very detailed chronicle of all of the different writers in the 19th century and the philosophical schools of thought they represented who had penned lives of Jesus. And what Schweitzer demonstrated in a very devastating exposé was that in virtually every case, these authors had simply recreated, today we might say reinvented, Jesus in the image of the school of philosophy to which they belonged. They were not doing pure historical research by a long shot. Interestingly, some would say ironically, Schweitzer himself was a member of a school of theological study that focused on apocalyptic literature. Literature about the end of the world. Literature from the ancient Jewish and Greek and Christian environment about how the only solution to humanity's plight would be for God to supernaturally intervene into the universe and recreate what humanity could never make right on its own. And ironically, as some would say, Schweitzer, after convincingly showing how so many others had recreated Jesus in their own image, so to speak, in the minds of many, fell victim to the same error as he portrayed in the closing chapters of his book, a Jesus who was a firebrand of a preacher, a radical apocalyptic who believed that God was going to bring about the end of the world within the lifetime of his followers, that his crucifixion would begin the events that would lead to this. But as history has shown, it turned out he was sadly mistaken. And because it became quickly apparent to other scholars that Schweitzer had fell victim to the very same trap that he had so carefully exposed in other writers, a period of time ensued, which some more recent scholars have simply dubbed the period of no quest. People still continued to study Jesus, they still continued to write books about him, but not nearly to the same degree, not nearly in the same number, and not nearly with the same confidence that much of anything could be known about Jesus if it seemed we were always doomed to recreate him in his own image. The dominant figure from roughly 1900 to 1950 in New Testament scholarship and in historical Jesus research in particular was another German by the name of Rudolf Bultmann, another man who lived into his 90s and had a very illustrious career. And in one famous quotation in an early writing, Bultmann said that all that we can be certain of about Jesus was that he existed. He moderated that skepticism as his career went on, and in fact he wrote a detailed book about the history of the synoptic tradition, the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in which he did indicate a number of things that he believed could be said about Jesus, but it was a very small shell of the sum total of the four Gospels in the New Testament. Interestingly, philosophically, Bultmann was an existentialist, and his Jesus was also an existentialist. But after World War II and all of the upheavals that that created in university life around the Western world, a trio of Bultmann's former graduate students, all now beginning and well into New Testament teaching careers, two of them German, Ernst Käsemann and Günther Bornkamm, and one of them an American who still teaches here in Southern California, though in retirement, James Robinson, all got together at a reunion in Marburg, Germany for former students of Rudolf Bultmann and held a conference in which papers were given. A couple of them were entitled The New Quest for the Historical Jesus. And these students had come to the conclusion that the skepticism of Bultmann was unwarranted and that more could be said and known about this figure who was the founder of Christianity. They analyzed Jesus' sayings in considerable detail. They suggested that he did and said things that at least implicitly suggested that he believed he was God's agent. Use the term cautiously, Messiah, if you like. But because of the era still coming out of the events of World War II, they focused, in the minds of most scholars who have subsequently read them, too much on Jesus' uniquenesses against his environment, and too little on the ways that Jesus was thoroughly and comfortably Jewish in his first century Jewish milieu. And so that movement too, after having its heyday in the early 50s and into about the mid-60s, began to tail off, and from roughly the mid-60s to about 1980, there was again a diminishing of interest and scholarly research in Jesus. That brings us to the last 20 years, if my arithmetic is still correct, 1980 to 2000, and what I have now labeled the current diversity. Perhaps the most publicized group of individuals to write and talk about Jesus in the last 20 years is a group that, from the perspective of a number of outsiders to their movement, still smacks of Bultmann and the New Quest in terms of a fairly outdated historical methodology, and that is the famous Jesus Seminar, centered for many of its events here in Southern California, publishing with Polebridge Press out of Sonoma. Robert Funk and John Dominic Crossan and Burton Mack, perhaps the three scholars who are both the most famous and most have spearheaded that movement from the mid-80s until quite recently. They became famous because they courted media attention and created two large books that were published in the 90s where every verse in the four Gospels and an apocryphal document known as the Gospel of Thomas were color-coded either red, pink, gray, or black according to the probability they thought that Jesus really said or did that particular item. When they came out with their book on the sayings of Jesus, The news that was flashed around the country was that only 18% of all of the sayings in all five Gospels were colored either red, Jesus said it exactly that way, or pink, we have it at least close, and only three sayings out of the entire Gospel of John were anything other than black, which means there must be some mistake. And that was a direct quote of the Jesus Seminar. But when one studied their methodology, one wasn't surprised by some of the results. As presuppositions, they ruled out of hand anything that is attributed to Jesus that can't be detached from its context. Unless something could have circulated as a short, proverbial, potentially cryptic saying all by itself, it doesn't qualify. Well, that wipes out a considerable amount to start with. Jesus could never have talked about the future. Never matter the question of whether he could predict the future. He didn't even talk about it. He never talked about judgment because judgment is not a worthy concept of an enlightened religion. He never talked about himself. No, it's not that he just didn't make exalted claims for himself. He never talked about himself and identified who he was in any category. Anybody know any religious teacher in the history of the world that didn't do that? And so it's not surprising that the resulting portraits of Jesus have been called by some more akin to a cynic sage, using cynic in the technical sense of the Greco-Roman school of philosophy, of the wandering cynics, itinerant philosophers who love to subvert the cultural mores of the day and point out flaws with received tradition and received wisdom and act in very countercultural ways in public. Never mind the fact that cynicism is the Greco-Roman philosophy that had least inroads into Israel of all, this is the portrait that emerges in many circles. But there is another spectrum. There is another development that is much more encouraging that has increasingly been called the third quest of the historical Jesus. Some of its defining characteristics include, very different from the first two, a conviction that any convincing portrait of Jesus must ground him thoroughly in early first century Israeli Judaism. He must make sense in a Jewish context, even when he differed from many of his contemporaries. It's not enough for the third quest to focus somewhat atomistically on individual sayings and deeds and try to rank their probability, but one has to ask broader, integrating questions. What were Jesus' aims? What were in his intentions? Particularly, what on earth got him crucified? The most secure fact historically, because we know it from both Jewish and Greco-Roman sources from the ancient world, what in the world got him crucified under Pontius Pilate? What was so dangerous or perceived to be dangerous or subversive about this man? And so different kinds of portraits are beginning to emerge. There's a growing appreciation that science has not disproved the miraculous in the least. Science, by definition, can only adjudicate on that which follows laws that are recurring and that can be traced and repeated in the laboratory with experiments. If there is a God, then it makes sense that he could, if he chose, at times suspend or work through in unique ways the forces of nature in ways that we cannot explain. And there is a recognition that the historical support, again, not simply within Christian sources, but outside Christian sources as well from the ancient world, is extremely strong, that Jesus was perceived as a miracle worker. And there is increasing agreement across many different parts of this spectrum that Jesus did indeed see himself as some kind of Messiah, some kind of Savior sent from God in ways that would have been perceived by at least some in his world as too exalted a claim and which could indeed get him in trouble with various authorities. Now, even as we keep narrowing things down, from the mythological to the scholarly to the old scholarship to newer scholarship to better newer scholarship, there still is a broad spectrum. A very helpful book by a man named Ben Witherington called The Jesus Quest, just out a couple of years ago. I have shamefacedly plagiarized the next titles from him, but since I've now acknowledged it, it's no longer plagiarism. There are scholars who have focused on elements in the Gospels that portray Jesus as what we might call a charismatic holy man. Someone who, like one or two other Jews that were written about in ancient rabbinic literature, completely outside all of the typical institutional channels of religious power, nevertheless had a charisma to their personality that attracted masses, taught important and helpful religious truths, had a reputation for working miracles, and challenged the authorities because they were perceived as a threat both in popularity and power to those authorities. There's another approach that has been labeled by Witherington, Jesus as a social reformer. And I've listed some scholarly names under all of these circles that you probably don't want to hear about in detail in this context, but we can get into them in the question and answer time if you'd like. There is an element in the Gospels that seems legitimately to point to Jesus as a wandering teacher who was trying to begin a renewal movement within Judaism and bring people who had fallen away from the morals of their own religion and the practices of their scriptures back to God, and who in doing so attracted crowds of others who went on the roads, much like a peripatetic philosopher in the Greco-Roman world, and literally took his message around the countryside. That he was in many ways protesting against social corruption and injustice in his society, and preaching a love for one's enemy, which is not a popular message in many cultures, modeling a kind of nonviolent resistance to oppression and injustice in ways that could very much irk both religious and political authorities in his day. There's another school that perhaps has received as much attention as any in this set of categories that harks back to Schweitzer's emphasis on Jesus as a prophet, one who looked to the future and who looked for God to soon intervene and create a new world and a new world order. It hasn't always been attached to the notion that Jesus had a timetable for all of this, so that one can look back and say he was mistaken. But there are some, including two books that are brand new this past summer, one by Paula Fredrickson from the University of Boston and one by Bart Ehrman from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, that have tried to revive even that dimension of Schweitzer's approach. Then there are writers who have focused on all of the allusions throughout Jesus' teaching to that body of Jewish literature known as wisdom literature, books like Proverbs and Psalms and Ecclesiastes, other intertestamental Jewish works that contained further proverbs and wise instruction, and that began to develop a notion found already in the Old Testament in Proverbs 8 and 9 of God Himself being personified as wisdom, so that wisdom isn't just an abstract virtue but begins to be a lady who can call out to the young men of the streets, come and learn from me and find wisdom from God. That branch can be subdivided into two quite different approaches. There is a burgeoning feminist scholarship, including in the study of the historical Jesus. The matriarch of that movement is almost certainly Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, now in partial retirement for many years at the University of Notre Dame, where the emphasis was on the fact that in both Hebrew and in Greek, wisdom was personified as a woman, and exploring all of the possibilities of Jesus alluding to and drawing on this divine feminine tradition. A man like Ben Witherington, a professor at Asbury Seminary in Kentucky, who also wrote the Jesus Quest that I alluded to, isn't so much concerned with gender issues as simply to show Jewish precedents for how Jesus and subsequent Christians could use language that sounded like language of divinity when the Jews were so unrelentingly monotheist. There is only one God and you cannot create another God. And then perhaps at the most conservative end of the spectrum are a number of scholars, not all of them evangelical Protestants by any means, who have focused on the question of Jesus seeing himself as a Messiah, even if he was, we might call, a marginalized Messiah, one who was not ultimately viewed in those categories by many in his world. One of these scholars, and I think now is the time for me to both sit down and take off my coat, basically because it's hot up here. I guess you're making up for the cool day I came into. A specific focus on a man who I think has done the work that may be the most significant historical Jesus research of the past decade, if not in a considerable longer time than that. His friends call him Tom Wright. His books use NT. If you want to tackle a bite-sized bit of Wright, he has written a little book called Who Was Jesus? If you want to tackle a medium-sized book, he has written The Challenge of Jesus. And if you want to get your PhD in New Testament, you will need to read the 700 small print pages, Jesus and the Victory of God. Wright, like many in the Third Quest, takes the more holistic or integrative approach of asking a narrative question. In all the diversity of first century Judaism, he observes there is one particular feature that any Galilean peasant fisherman waking up and going out to the lake for his morning's work would have daily been reminded of. The Jews, you see, believed that they were God's elect people. They believed that God had chosen to deal with them in certain unique ways that he had not chosen to deal with any other people he created. They believed their scriptures were the infallible, inerrant word of God, and in those scriptures, Christians today call them the Old Testament, it was said over and over and over again that if the Jews would follow God and accept his covenant, they would live in the promised land. They would live in the land of Israel, and they would live in the land in freedom from any invading power, and in peace without warfare, and in prosperity, enjoying the fruit of the land. But you see, in the first half of the first century, Rome had been an occupying force since 63 BC. No one living in the time of Christ, except perhaps the very oldest, by the time he began his public ministry, could ever have remembered a time when the Jews were a free people in the land the infallible God had promised to them in their inerrant scriptures. And so the question was, what went wrong? And what are we to do about it in order to claim those promises? Wright also wrote a book called The New Testament and the People of God, which goes into Jewish backgrounds in great detail and in a very fascinating way takes a look at all of the different Jewish groups and sects that we've ever uncovered and know about. And one can differentiate them in very helpful ways by asking and answering, as best we can, that specific question. The problem was the problem of exile, of not living in freedom. Many Jews were literally in exile, scattered around the Roman Empire, but even those that were living in their homeland were not living in freedom, free to enact and enforce their own laws and obey their God in all the ways they wanted to. What's gone wrong and what are we to do about it is an excellent way to get a handle on all the diversity of first century Judaism. Jesus, as a first century Jew, belongs in that spectrum of answers. And Wright's thesis, boiled down the 700-page book or the 300-page book or the 150-page book to one sentence, which would never be fair, but we'll try anyway, is that Jesus came announcing that the exile was over without one Roman soldier having been removed from his post. Makes no sense. How can this be? Well, because in Jesus' teaching, according to Wright, and I think he's right, Jesus implicitly and explicitly made five significant redefinitions of very central Jewish tenets. He redefined monotheism. The Lord our God, the Lord is one, is straight out of the heart of the Jewish law, and Jesus quoted it and affirmed it. But yet he spoke about himself, and he spoke about the invisible Spirit of God in ways that would at least plant the seeds for what later was called the doctrine of the Trinity. That somehow God was involved with himself and with the Spirit that empowered him in a way that at the very least became problematic for many Jewish people. Secondly, he redefined the doctrine of election. No, I'm not talking about Bush versus Gore. Instead of one ethnic group being the guaranteed ticket to being part of God's chosen people, Jesus taught that his followers of any ethnic group, Certainly, all of his first followers were Jews, but not all Jews became his followers. Only a small minority did. He also traveled occasionally outside of Israel, engaged in brief ministry to Gentile, non-Jewish people, and planted the seeds for a substantial Gentile mission following his death. Thirdly, he implicitly and explicitly redefined liberation or salvation. Rome was not the worst enemy. Satan was. The devil. Or to put it another way, it's not political freedom that is the most important issue, it's spiritual freedom. Although we do have to remember that the separation of church and state was an American notion invented a little over 200 years ago, and nobody would have thought of politics and religion not being intimately intertwined in the ancient world. Fourthly, he redefined the Messiah and his role, focusing on passages of Scripture, particularly out of the prophecies of Isaiah 52 and 53 that spoke about a suffering servant who would be despised and rejected and die, and the sins of the world would be placed on him, and by his sufferings humanity would be healed. Text that most Jews thought was being fulfilled corporately by the people of Israel, that they were suffering for the sins of the world. Jesus understood that as a messianic job description, if you like. And so instead of leading a group of soldiers in warfare against Rome, saw his death as central to his mission. And then finally, and fifthly, redefined the notion of a new age, of a messianic age, of that coming time of a golden era of peace and prosperity as something that in fact would have to come in two stages. So that there were many Old Testament prophecies that were fulfilled in his lifetime, but that there were many left to be fulfilled, including the vision of universal peace and lion lying down with the lamb, and a little child leading the wild animals without being harmed. That reconstruction of Jesus, I would like to suggest, makes sense, and it helps us to answer some of those bigger questions like, why was Jesus crucified? Now, Wright is a believer, but he writes, a lot of puns here, as a historian, and does not intentionally presuppose his belief in his historical work. So one of the things that he very helpfully does is develop a historical methodology considerably more sophisticated than the previous quests have developed. Where in the past the tendency has been to see Jesus just in his uniqueness over against Judaism, Wright develops what he calls the double similarity and dissimilarity criterion. What does that mouthful mean? Well, he points to a number of features of repeated, frequently attested information about Jesus, both inside the Gospels and elsewhere, that fulfills actually four separate criteria. This criterion really has four parts to it. First of all, it must make sense within first century Judaism. Nobody can be so totally different from their culture that they're not even intelligible within it. But secondly, for Jesus to have had the effect and in essence start an entirely new religious movement, he had to have differed in significant ways from conventional Judaism. Similarly, there will be lines of continuity between what he did and taught and the movement he founded, the early church and emerging Christianity, but there will also be differences, ways in which his followers were not able to keep his high standard, in which some of his harder teachings were misunderstood or toned down. And when one particular theme or teaching fits all four of those criteria, or that one four-part criterion simultaneously, it's quite likely we have genuine historical tradition that wouldn't have been made up by anybody else. interestingly, a large number of the major themes of the Gospels, particularly Matthew, Mark, and Luke, pass through this grid and come out with flying colors. If all of that approximates what someone simply wearing a historian's hat, not necessarily presupposing faith in God or in the Bible of Christians, if anything like that is close to being true, then we have an explanation for the polarization that occurred in Jesus' day. And the polarization that is still occurring in many parts of the world, as there are a record number of Christians as we speak, suffering as martyrs for the Christian faith. More in the 20th century than in the previous 19 centuries of Christian history alone. It's ironic that we can live in the United States, and particularly in university campuses, but scarcely limited to them, where the attitude is, whatever works for you is fine, you do your thing, I'll do mine, all things are equal, all things are equally true, when people are dying for their faiths, and not just Christianity, in other parts of the world where people perhaps recognize better than we do that if certain religious claims are true, then other ones are dangerous and cannot be tolerated, and vice versa. The redefinitions that Wright describes of Judaism that Jesus brought would have transcended enough of the conventional boundaries of acceptable Jewish faith, and in arousing mass interest and attention, would have also caught the attention of the Roman authorities, who were very concerned to keep the peace, and very plausibly explain why Jesus, according to the Gospels, was condemned by a Jewish court for blasphemy and by a Roman tribunal for sedition or insurrection. Maybe the more astounding question to ask is, why did any Jew ever follow Jesus with such radical redefinitions? Not many of them do today. But all of the first Christians were Jews, and for at least one generation in early Christianity, the substantial majority of Christians were Jews, and there has always been a Jewish Christian wing of the church throughout history, though in some times and places it has been very small. Maybe the amazing thing is not that Jesus was put to death in his environment, but that anybody out of a Jewish milieu followed him at all. How could they have? And here, I think, is an untapped argument that Christians and non-Christians alike have not, I think, wrestled much with. On the one hand, there have been scholars who have done quite a bit of work in recent years, perhaps a Canadian man now teaching in Edinburgh, Scotland, by the name of Larry Hurtado, has done more than anyone, to point out that the kind of monotheism that preceded the destruction of Jerusalem by Rome in AD 70 and a re-entrenchment of the Jewish religion that followed that date was more diverse, did allow for some pretty exalted things to be said about people who were not God. In the intertestamental Jewish literature, angels, the patriarchs like Abraham and Moses, later heroes of the Jewish faith like Kings David and Solomon, and others are spoken of in very exalted language. There's an intriguing passage in Daniel 7:9 that speaks of two thrones in heaven. One is obviously God's, but who is sitting at his right hand if there is only one God? And there was Jewish speculation that maybe it was an archangel. There's even a document that came out of those Dead Sea Scrolls that proposed it was Melchizedek. And if you know who Melchizedek is, I know you've been a Christian for some time. Either that or you're really a scholar. An obscure priest back in Genesis who is referred to in a few other passages throughout the Bible. So there was freedom in ways that the Jewish faith later, we might say, clamped down on to speak of people other than Yahweh, the God of Israel, in very lofty heavenly language. That's part of the logical or conceptual possibility that lies behind Jesus and the apostles' words, though admittedly Jesus pushed things further to suggest, at least in some sense, actual equality with God. The other piece of the argument, I think, again following a British writer by the name of James Dunn, is what I've called the experiential necessity. These Jews, initially 12 disciples, then large crowds, then many of the crowds fell away, but immediately after the account of his resurrection, we read of 120, and the Apostle Paul talks about a larger group of 500 who were witnesses. Early in the book of Acts, the numbers are up into the thousands of Jews in the Jerusalem area alone who have become followers of this new movement. There was apparently something in the experience, on the one hand, of those who walked and talked and lived and ate and slept with Jesus, whose humanity they never would have questioned, that suggested to them they simply could not describe him within the friendly confines, not of Wrigley Field, near the state where I grew up, but in the friendly confines of conventional Jewish monotheism. They never denied there was only one God, but somehow they had to start speaking of Jesus in similar language. And for those who only experienced Jesus and his power through the power of the Holy Spirit after the resurrection, they had to say the same thing about that power which they perceived to be a personal power, not an impersonal force that they called the Spirit of God. So, what to conclude, since my watch says it's time? C.S. Lewis, the famous British writer, professor of English literature, Christian apologist of a generation ago, made very famous an argument for Christianity, which was popularized in this country by a well-known lifelong member of Campus Crusade, which some of you are a part of, Josh McDowell. And the way Lewis posed what McDowell called a trilemma, which is a dilemma plus one, went something like this. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him, that is Jesus. Namely, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Unquote. That's the one thing, Lewis writes, we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would be either a lunatic on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. Or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come, still Lewis's words, they may sound a little harsh in our modern age of tolerance, but let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. If you go back to the pages of the Gospels, you can find all three of those options. You can find some of his brothers and sisters in Mark chapter 3 coming and saying publicly, he's mad. In that same chapter, a little bit further on, you can find certain Jewish leaders saying, he casts out demons by the power of Beelzebul, who was the name for the devil. He was either demented or demonic, to change the alliteration, or he was divine. It's interesting that the most pervasive Jewish tradition, non-Christian Jewish tradition, in several sources over the next 400 to 500 years of the era in which Judaism and Christianity overlapped, was that Jesus was a sorcerer who led Israel astray. No attempt to deny the miracles, no attempt to deny the exorcisms, in fact, tacit admission of both. But convinced that his power was not from God, but from a different supernatural, a diabolical power. I entitled the section just before the conclusion, The Resulting Polarization Then and Now. And I'd like to suggest, not that I want to turn the United States into the Middle East. Don't hear me wrong. I'm not for violence. I come from Littleton, Colorado, which probably means something to some of you. But the parts of the world and the places where people hear the message of Jesus carefully enough to realize that stakes of life and death are involved here probably understand things better, whichever side they come down on, than the sort of general apathetic, pluralistic environment of you do your thing and I'll do mine and everything is fine for everybody as long as it works for them. I would hope, as I trust is the purpose of all of these Veritas forums that you've had a number of in the last few years here, that you would accept the challenge, if you have never done so before, to study Jesus, to study him as a man of history, not necessarily presupposing the truth of Christianity or of the scriptural testimony about him, but that if you do so with an open mind, it will bring you to a point where a decision needs to be made that could lead to an entire change of your life or direction or allegiance, because that's what the historical Jesus, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, though not all, was in fact about.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.